Good morning, brothers and sisters. I am reminded to be thankful for the sound booth this morning. When they get noticed, something has gone wrong, and I thought, we're not noticing them. And particularly, I've noticed my microphone has never come on when we are worshiping. And that is a very good thing. I can sing from the bottom of my heart, the top of my lungs, and I'm safe. And don't get any ideas. Michael gave me the thumbs up. All right. Well, welcome to summer. I think this week we start our endless 90-degree days, and we're above 70 at night. It's a real bummer. We live out in the country. We like to open our windows, get that cool night air. It's not going to be there for a while, I'm afraid. Time to stay hydrated, I guess. I hope you, the World Cup does not know how to operate a bracket contest. It was final like last night sometime late, and they start the first game today at 2. I can't pick a bracket in, well, especially in these hours, but I mean, I can tell you're not with me. You guys don't do bracket contests. We love games at our house, and we're all, I convinced everybody to do some picking, but we'll see. The next thing on the calendar, I had no idea, totally snuck up on me. We had graduation and wedding, got a baby coming, and the 250th anniversary of the 4th of July. That's coming. We're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of our country's founding before we meet again. On Sunday, you might have a week-in-week meeting, but I have to do this for you. Are you ready? We are going to celebrate the semi-quincentennial. Yeah. I was down in Texas during their 150th anniversary, and I learned to say sesquicentennial, like just roll it out. So I've been practicing a lot just to say semi-quincentennial. It's three Latin roots. I know you're dying to know this. Semi means half, quin means five, centennial is 100th anniversary. So what you have there is half, semi, of five 100 centennials. Half of 500 is 250. And I'm looking at our theologian here, and he's nodding. So that was good math there. Got you, Jackson. Okay. We have a lot to be thankful for in our country. I know when we sing, you will probably hear "God Bless America" sometime in the next few days, within a week. And all I can think is God has certainly blessed America, and it would be our desire to see America bless God. Watching our culture is a concerning thing. Well, we need to get to business, right? So where are we in Hebrews today? We're winding down in the hall of faith. This is, in some ways, the last day of, we call it a plaque day. You know, you go through the hall of fame and you see a plaque and someone's name on it. This is the last day we're really going to look specifically and long into the life of an individual who has been held up for us to recognize their faith. Next week it will be a summary statement, more or less, from our author, which basically says we do not have enough time to talk about everybody who has lived by faith. We are only seeing the tip of the iceberg. And that is the impression he wants to put upon his audience. It is by nature that we walk by faith. People of God walk by faith, and they are looking at turning back to an old system that they can see and get their hands on, and he's calling them forward. No, we need to walk by faith. What have we seen? Well, we've seen the faith of Abel offering a better sacrifice than Cain, the faith of Enoch, who walked with God and was pleasing to God, the faith of Noah, who in reverence prepared an ark, the faith of Abraham, The faith of Abraham, who obeyed when he was called, lived as an alien in the land of promise, with Sarah, fathered Isaac beyond the proper time in life, and offered up Isaac when he was tested, and finally lived as a stranger and an exile on the earth, not just in the promised land, but on the earth. He was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. In fact, our text tells us this is what all these people of faith were seeking: not a kingdom on earth, but a better country that is a heavenly one, a heavenly one. Following Abraham, we looked at the faith of the other sojourning patriarchs, Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. Isaac and Jacob blessing their sons by faith in regards to the yet unfulfilled promise to Abraham, and Joseph, which just kills me, giving directions. Here's what to do with my bones. Do not bury them here in Egypt. Take them to the promised land. You're going there. You are going there. Well, last week we began looking into the faith of Moses, which began with his parents, and we were on Father's Day. I thought nothing could be more appropriate. Amram and Jochebed, who hid Moses for 3 months when he was born because they were not afraid of the king's edict. And then Moses himself, as a grown man with the world at his fingertips, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So what did he do? What did he choose? Choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God. The people of God. This morning we will continue looking into the faith of Moses, followed by the children of Israel, which I titled The People of God, as our author has. And finally, the faith of an extremely well-known convert, Rahab. So join me in your copy of the Scriptures. Yes, we're in Hebrews 11, and I will begin reading at verse 27. We'll read through verse 31. Hebrews 11, verse 27. By faith he left Egypt. Of course, the he there is Moses. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. And the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab, the harlot, did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, as we gather around your word, ready our hearts and our minds to receive it. Clear away the distractions of the past week, the worries of the days ahead. Grant us clarity and focus now in this moment. Touch our hearts with conviction where we need it, our minds with truth where there is error or misunderstanding, and our will, Lord, with a thirst for obedience. In Jesus' name, amen. Our text opens, by faith, he left Egypt. By faith, he left Egypt. This is a progression. This is the next step. Last week, we read, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So as a mature man, that phrase when he had grown up, literally translates having become great. Stephen tells us he was a man of power in words and deeds. At that moment, he refused identification with Pharaoh's household. Now, he leaves. Born, mature, refuses, and now leaves. Leaves. By faith, he left Egypt. How did that happen? Well, one particular thing, one signal act of his rejection of his position of Egyptian power, his power in the Egyptian monarchy, his rejection of that came when he executed an Egyptian who was beating a Hebrew. You're like, what are you doing? Whose side are you on? You can imagine the reaction. He's not just refusing privilege now, but he's acting against the source of that privilege and for the people of God, for the Hebrews. The story is found in Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. Yes, we're going to be back and forth between Hebrews and Exodus, and we're even going to hit Joshua. So I would put a marker there in Hebrews 11. We'll be back. But right now, we want to catch the story in Exodus 2. Exodus 2:11. We're going to read eventually through verse 15, but I'm going to start in Exodus 2:11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, there's our language, our author's language, when Moses had grown up, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So Moses is not talking. He is taking action. What would an Egyptian do if an Egyptian saw one of their own beating a Hebrew slave? Well, they would do nothing. That's what an Egyptian would do. They would do nothing at all. They might even cheer him on. Go to it, brother. Or they might breathe a sigh of relief. Got to keep those Hebrews down. Not Moses. Note what he does here. However, he may have thought of himself before. He is not thinking of himself as an Egyptian anymore. That is clear. But knowing there are going to be repercussions for this action. We'll pick up the reading in verse 13. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" He's like, "You guys are brothers. You're both Hebrews. What are you doing beating on each other?" His actions don't make any sense to a man who just took out an Egyptian for beating a Hebrew. He doesn't get the reaction he thinks he's going to get, though. Verse 14, but he said, this would be the man who was striking his companion, had the advantage. "Who made you a prince or judge over us?" And there's your whoops. The Hebrews, slaves in Egypt, did not get the word. It's interesting to me to think about this, though. They will get the word because a prince and judge is exactly what Moses will be in time. He just isn't at the moment. The Hebrew continues, "Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." Moses knows there will be some trouble. There's going to be some backlash. Backlash shows up in verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. There's a double emphasis there, settled and sat down. The author is telling us he's hunkering down in Midian. So our text tells us, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. And that presents us with a little bit of a problem, because Exodus tells us, then Moses was afraid. The Hebrews text, not fearing the wrath of the king. How do we understand this paradox? This is a paradox. It's an apparent contradiction. And essentially, every commentator I read addresses this issue. And so will we. So a body of scholars have coalesced around the idea that, well, this isn't the only time Moses left Israel. Left Egypt. They argue that this description fits better with his second departure from Egypt during the Exodus than it does this departure. He certainly exhibited no fear in that moment, so surely this must be what our author is referring to. Unfortunately, here we find, I believe, even more difficulties. The well-known commentator Franz Delitzsch points out that the Exodus departure was not only not done without fear, but at the demand of Pharaoh. I'm at Exodus 12 now. Turn forward 10 chapters. Exodus 12, verses 31 and 32, reads as follows. Exodus 12, 31. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night. Now, this is at the conclusion of the final plague, the death of the firstborn, right? Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, rise up, get out from among my people, both of you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also. Your action here is, well, of course there is no fear in this moment. There is no need to point that out and call it faith. Additionally, Delitzsch points out that the expression here in Hebrews is, quote, too individual to be applied to the Exodus, where Moses and Israel are now associated together, prince and people, shepherd and flock, unquote. It is indeed odd to refer to the exodus of an entire nation as he left Egypt. But probably, at least for me, the most decisive difficulty with this interpretation is the chronology. We've been watching this all along. Our author has been operating chronologically from the beginning of the Hall of Faith in the series of events in the life of Abraham, and now in the life of Moses. If this is a reference to the Exodus, then when we get to verse 28 and we start talking about the Passover, we're moving backward in time. It would be birth, manhood, Exodus. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. Passover. It just doesn't seem likely and seems rather uncharacteristic of our author. So where do we go? This presses us to look for a better interpretation, a different explanation. The general approach, then, to understanding this as the first departure of Moses from Egypt to Midian revolves around that word fear. The fear discussed in the passage in Exodus speaks directly of discovery, of having been found out. It reads, then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. However, the author of Hebrews speaks of not fearing the wrath of the king. The wrath of the king would be wrath that would follow an act of disloyalty. He did not fear that. Being discovered would produce an inevitable fear, an objective fear, and a need to to avoid execution, to take action. This is different from not fearing the wrath of Pharaoh, not fearing the wrath of an earthly king when he discovers that my allegiance is no longer to him. I was thought to be one of his top lieutenants. He discovers I am no more. I am aligning myself with the people of God. Guthrie summarizes all of this most simply with this. The author of Hebrews wishes to emphasize the boldness of Moses' actions rather than the negative emotion of dread. He made a decision to leave Egypt, and that step the writer understands as a step of faith. Additionally, I think compelling to this idea, this is Moses' departure for the desert of Midian, is how our author continues. Notice where he moves forward. He says, for he endured, going forward in our text, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. For he endured. Again, Dalich points out how this aligns with his time in the desert of Midian. Think of 40 years in the desert of Midian, quote, among all the hardships of a long voluntary exile, he was steadfast in his purpose to remain at a distance from Egypt and its king, unquote. He did not return to Egypt and submit. He did not attempt to make peace, obtain mercy from Pharaoh, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. It's a beautiful phrase, as seeing him who is unseen. It's poetic. Just as no one has seen God at any time, by faith he sees him. By faith he is sustained in seeing the unseen. So, in conclusion, by faith he left Egypt. Now, continuing to verse 28, this is the fourth and final act noted by our author regarding Moses. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood. We have now moved forward 40 years. The Passover is the central element of the final plague in Egypt. They were to kill an unblemished lamb, an unblemished year-old lamb, apply its blood to the doorframe of their home. In Exodus 12 and 13, the Lord tells Moses and Aaron what will happen. Here we are, Exodus 12, 12 and 13. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. When our author tells us Moses kept the Passover, we think kind of like the other passage we were just at. Everybody kept the Passover. Why is this a special mark of faith for just Moses? Well, the answer lies in the word kept. Ken Wiest tells us this word translated kept means to make, which in this context means to institute. Homer Kent continues, the use of the perfect tense suggests a continuing state and should be understood here in the sense that Moses established the observance of the Passover at the Exodus, but it was intended to be a perpetual feast. Now take a look back at Exodus 12, 14. Now this day will be a memorial to you. Sorry, I did that quickly. Exodus 12, 14. If you're there and you can find that place. Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. So, by faith, Moses kept, as in put in place, inaugurated, established the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood. That phrase, "and the sprinkling of the blood," this is a direct reference to the very first Passover. They were to take hyssop, a sturdy, fibrous herb. It was dipped in the blood and then used to sprinkle the blood on the doorframe. After this first Passover, the blood was poured on the altar. Our author concludes with the purpose statement, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. He who destroyed the firstborn would not touch the Hebrews. It goes without saying, but here Moses is operating by faith, trusting in the word of God, leading the children of Israel forward in obedience. There was nothing in Moses' previous experience that would lead him to these actions. He led the children of Israel forward solely under the conviction that God had spoken and they must follow. They must trust and obey. Well, that is the conclusion of Moses' acts of faith. We are now moved forward with three examples from the children of Israel. The first one begins, I'm back now in Hebrews, hopefully you got your marker there. The first one begins in verse 29 with those who just by faith went through the first Passover. Verse 29, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. By faith they, children of Israel, passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. The first thing we notice is the plural pronoun they. All other acts of faith have been ascribed to individuals. Here we have a body of people acting in faith. And interestingly, not a body of people, the wilderness generation, who are remembered for their faith. But here they are. How does this happen? On Exodus from Egypt, God does not lead them. This is really intriguing to me. He doesn't lead them straight directly to the promised land. Back to Exodus 13. The text tells us, Exodus 13:17. Now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. This is a short path. We didn't go that way, for God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Where does God lead them? He leads them to camp, ultimately, in front of the Red Sea. The Egyptians then are regretting letting them go and come after them. So the children of Israel now have the Red Sea behind them, and the charging Egyptians directly in front of them. And I think I see them licking their chops. These fools are lost. They don't know where they're going. They back themselves up to the Red Sea. This is going to be a massacre. Unfortunately, the children of Israel are thinking the same thing, and they are beginning to grumble and complain. But Moses tells them, turn with me to Exodus 14. Exodus 14:13 is where we'll start reading. Exodus 14:13. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. That's what you call emphatic. Verse 14, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And I'm thinking, wow. I can't even imagine the ditch water parting for me. This has to be the most astounding sight. Would it take a little faith to step into the dry bed of the Red Sea between two walls of water? You think about that. Oh, no, man, I would dive right. This is so cool. I would just, yes, we would do that because we know exactly how this is going to go. We know what's coming. They did not. They did not. We know how the story ends. They did not. How far did they have to go? Now, I have memories of watching the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, and I'm thinking my memory is, you know, it's you know, a few hundred yards. Well, modern Red Sea, the contemporary Red Sea, the narrowest point of the contemporary Red Sea is 16 miles. What was it in that day? I don't know, but it was more than what Charlton Heston had to do. That I am sure. I'm just thinking, not a little sprint. I step down into this dry riverbed. I have these walls of water on either side of me, and I'm walking, and I'm walking, and I'm walking, and I'm walking, and I'm walking. If it's 16 miles, that's over half a marathon. I have a daughter that can run that pretty fast. It would still take her quite a while. Quite a while. And then the question has to come to us. What is God asking you to do right now? It's probably, as the Israelites face, something a little outside their comfort zone. Question for us, will we walk by faith? Will we take God at His word? Go, tell the people, go forward. Go forward. Will we take Him at His word and walk by faith? How does this story end? You could end the story right there, right? Thy faith, they crossed the Red Sea on dry ground. Doesn't end there. God instructs Moses to raise his arms once again and let the waters come back over the Egyptians. It's Exodus 14, dropping down to verse 27 now. Verse 27, so Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. Our author notes this detail back in Hebrews 11. And the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. Interesting. He wouldn't have to point that out. We see the faith of the children of Israel. That's enough, right? But Morris makes this interesting observation that their faith, and not merely their courage, was important, is shown by the fate of the Egyptians, who showed themselves to be very courageous, but were not people, were not men of faith. Courage won't make it happen. We must have faith in God, follow Him, and obey him. Our last two events are linked. We see corporate faith once again, and then back to individual faith. We move forward 40 years. The wilderness generation that walked through the Red Sea on dry ground refused to enter the promised land due to the fear-filled report of 10 spies. Due to their lack of faith, God allowed that generation to die in the wilderness over the course of 40 years of wandering. We're now with the new generation led by Joshua. Hebrews 11, verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. That's a really short, concise statement, isn't it? The walls of Jericho fell down after they'd been encircled for 7 days. Sounds a little curious. Let's read. I'm heading for Joshua chapter 6 now. Joshua chapter 6, verse 2. Joshua chapter 6. That's at the conclusion of the Pentateuch. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Joshua. Joshua chapter 6, verse 2. See if we can pick up a few details. Help us understand. What? Deuteronomy, Joshua. I skipped Deuteronomy. We're right in style. Well, you are listening. Apparently, I'm not. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Right there is Joshua. No. Deuteronomy, Joshua. Wow. I got to stop and take a drink. Plenty of time for everyone to find Joshua, right? Hopefully you're not still looking after Numbers. You're after Deuteronomy. Okay. Here we go. Joshua chapter 6, verse 2. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also, seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the seventh day, you shall march around the city 7 times. And the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people will go up, every man, straight ahead. This means there aren't going to be a few cracks in the wall. The whole thing's coming down so that everyone can walk straight in. Note, there is no military strategy here. No one's ever copied this tactic. There is no military might here. There is nothing there. It is absolutely, I'm sorry, I would say bonkers. This would not make you a general. These instructions, no military intelligence involved. What it appears to me is God is making a point. I will now do for you what I was going to do for the Exodus generation, but they lacked faith. They did not trust and obey. So what actually happened? Well, verses 6 through 19 are going to give you all the details. I'm not going to read all those to you. I am going to skip all the way to the final result in verse 20. And I am still in Joshua chapter 6. You've got me on edge now. Joshua chapter 6, verse 20. Here we go. So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. We have to think about that for a minute. Think of it. Yes. Thank you, Lisa. Yeah, this does not make sense. This does not make sense. Israel's men of war. I have no idea how valiant they were. You imagine some of these guys being a little large and a little buff. I have no idea how valiant they were, because to follow that battle plan took faith. It had to be counter to absolutely every instinct they possessed. And think of all the hours they may have spent practicing with weapons of war. They had to feel a little bit ridiculous. Just walking around. Oh man, I remember the Battle of Jericho. That was a tough one. Oh yeah, I sprung an arch and had to keep walking. There's nothing here. They had to feel a little ridiculous. There was no glory in this battle for them. No glory in this battle for them. And that just rings. When we walk by faith, God receives the glory. It's not about us. It's about Him. It's about Him. Well, we now move from the faith of the children of Israel, from corporate faith back to the faith of an individual, Rahab, the harlot. Reading again, I'm moving back now to Hebrews chapter 11. I don't know if I'll try to name a reference in the Old Testament again. Thank you. Hebrews 11, verse 31. By faith, Rahab, the harlot, did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Rahab is our first outsider on this list. She was a Canaanite and a harlot, a prostitute. And you know, it was never forgotten. In both our New Testament text in Hebrews and in James, she is known as Rahab the harlot. Rahab the harlot. But our text tells us she did not perish along with those who were disobedient. Who are the disobedient people that are referred to here? Well, this would be the people group she belonged to, the Canaanites. Along with known for being extremely cruel, they were known for being grossly immoral, debauched, perverse, wicked. An example that I have here, which I have become timid, and I will not read. It is just simply too graphic. Utterly barbaric people, take my word for it, utterly barbaric and horrific in their willingness to commit evil. But out of this people, God saved Rahab the harlot. Out of that background, what did she do? Remember, our verse began, by faith, Rahab. And our verse ends, after she had welcomed the spies in peace. After she had welcomed the spies in peace. There's a little bit of breadth here to this term. Wiest gives us the words with peace speak of the act of Rahab in receiving the spies without enmity. And in not allowing them to suffer harm from others. Not allowing them to suffer harm from others. That is a good description of what she did. Joshua had sent out two men, to spy out the land, particularly Jericho, he told them he was interested in. She not only welcomed the spies, she hid them on the roof of her house when the king of Jericho came knocking. He had heard. He came to interrogate her about the Israelite men. What about these Israelite men she had taken in? She said, I didn't know they were Israelites. She absolutely knew they were Israelites. She sent the king's men on a wild goose chase. Oh, head out over here. The gates of the city are shut. The men search party went out. The Israelite spies are hiding on the roof. After the town was completely locked down, her house being in the wall of the city, she let the men down by a rope. Her testimony to the spies is captivating, and it is found in Joshua chapter 2, and I'm going to recommend that for a good Sunday afternoon reading, if you can find the book. I'm sorry, I tend not to let things go. I just think that's really amazing. Okay. Anyway, Joshua chapter 2. I'm going to read you the smallest of snippets. Listen to this testimony. This is verse 11, and the second half, just 11b. Listen to what she says. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. He's God. He is God. She tells also of having the people with the fear of their God, the Hebrews' God, being terrifying the people of Jericho. And she knows what's coming. She knows He is God, and she requests, I will describe it briefly as sanctuary. So how strong was her faith in this confession? For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. I would say quite strong. Strong enough to put her life at risk. We don't think about what she did too much. Oh yeah, sure, she hid the spies. That's nice. No, she would have been destroyed. And when you read of the brutality of this people, she would have been destroyed in brutal fashion had her hiding these spies, protecting them, and setting them loose had been discovered. Had they found out what she had been up to, harboring Israelite spies and misleading the king of Jericho, her life would have been destroyed. Well, this is the end today. I have just a few thoughts for application. Just want to run through each of these folks. I trust that God has spoken to you from His Word. I'm thinking of Moses and the children of Israel at the Red Sea, both of them. Faith and fear do not mix. Faith and fear do not mix. When fear gets a hold of us, faith will be driven out, vice versa. When faith gets a hold of us, fear will be driven out. Think of the Passover, all those instructions, do it, do this, do that. Never seen anything like this before. Trust and obey. Trust and obey. Think of the walls of Jericho. I think when we walk by faith, God receives the glory. Sometimes I think that's what keeps us from walking by faith. We are interested. I won't throw you under the bus with me. I am interested in my own glory. I am not interested enough in God's. Walk by faith, God receives the glory. And think of Rahab, wherever you have done and wherever you have been, by faith, God's grace and mercy can reach you. Let's close in prayer. Father, so many people of faith we've looked at today, so many lessons to be learned, to be taken to heart. Where do we start? Lord, You know each of our hearts. So I pray that you would grant each of us clarity today. Show us, Lord, what we need to do so that this time in your word finds its way into our walk with you, our walk by faith. In Jesus' name, amen.